proper amount, though many pride themselves on giving more. The same would be true for you, she said dismissively, if you stood a fiddler's chance in hell of ever wearing the red. Seeing my astonishment, she explained, it is not so much when you think of it. For years the school feeds and clothes you. It gives you a place to sleep. It gives you your sword, your training. After this investment, the mercenary supports the school. The school supports the village. The village produces children who hope to someday take the red. She made a circle with her finger. Thus all Edemre thrives. Bachette gave me a grave look. Knowing this, perhaps you can begin to understand what you have stolen, she said. Not just a secret, but the major export of the Edem. You have stolen the key to this entire town's survival. It was a sobering thought. Suddenly, Carceret's anger made much better sense. I caught a glimpse of Cheyenne's white shirt and roughly knitted yellow cap through the crowd. The scattered conversations grew still, and everyone began to gather into a large, loose circle. It wasn't just Cheyenne fighting today, apparently. The first to fight were two boys a few years younger than myself, neither of them wearing red. They circled each other warily, then fell on each other in a flurry of blows. It was too fast for my eye to follow, and I saw a dozen half-formed pieces of the K-10 scattered and discarded. It finally ended when one boy caught the other's wrist and shoulder in Sleeping Bear. It was only when I saw the boy twist his opponent's arm and force him to the ground that I recognized it as the grip Tempe had used in the bar fight in Crossan. The boys separated, and two red-shirted mercenaries came out to talk to them, presumably their teachers. Bachette leaned her head close to mine. What do you think? They're very quick, I said. She looked at me. But? They seem rather sloppy, I said, being careful to speak quietly. Not at first, but after they started. I pointed at one. His feet were too close together, and the other kept leaning forward so his balance was off. That's how he got caught in Sleeping Bear. Bachette nodded, pleased. They fight like puppies. They are young and boys. They are full of anger and impatience. Women have less trouble with these things. It's part of what makes us better fighters. I was more than slightly surprised to hear her say that. Women are better fighters? I asked carefully, not wanting to contradict her. Generally speaking, she said matter-of-factly, there are exceptions, of course, but as a whole, women are better. But men are stronger, I said. Taller. They have better reach. She turned to look at me, slightly amused. Are you stronger and taller than me, then? I smiled. Obviously not. But as a whole, you have to admit, men are bigger and stronger. Bachette shrugged. And that would matter if fighting were the same as splitting wood or hauling hay. That is like saying a sword is better the longer and heavier it is. Foolishness. Perhaps for thugs this is true, but after taking the red, the key is knowing when to fight. Men are full of anger, so they have trouble with this. Women, less so. I opened my mouth, then thought of Daydan, and closed it. A shadow fell over us, and I looked up to see a tall man in his red standing at a polite distance. He held his hand poised near the hilt of his sword. Invitation. Bachette gestured back, gentle regret and refusal. I watched as he walked away. Won't they think less of you for not fighting? Bachette sniffed disdainfully. He didn't want to fight, she said. It would only embarrass him and waste my time. He merely wanted to show he was brave enough to fight me. She sighed and gave me a pointed look. It is that sort of foolishness that leads men from the Latani. The next match was between two red-shirted mercenaries, and the difference was obvious. Everything was much cleaner and crisper. The two boys had been frantic as sparrows flapping in the dust, but the fights that followed were elegant as dances. Many of the bouts were hand-fighting. These lasted until one person submitted or was visibly stunned by a blow. One fight stopped immediately when a man bloodied his opponent's nose. Bachette rolled her eyes at this, though I couldn't tell if she thought less of the woman for allowing herself to be struck or the man for being reckless enough to hurt her. There were several bouts with wooden swords, too. These tended to go more quickly, as even a light touch was considered enough for a victory. "Who won that one?" I asked, after a quick exchange of clacking swordplay ended with both women scoring hits at the same time. "Neither," she said, frowning. "Why don't they fight again if it was a tie?" I asked. Vachette frowned at me. "It wasn't a tie, strictly speaking. Dren would have died in minutes, struck through the lung. Lazrael would have died in days when the wound in her gut soured."
"So Lazrael won?"
Vachette gave me a look of withering contempt and turned her attention back to the next fight. The tall Adem man who had asked Vachette to fight was bouting with a thin whip of a woman. Strangely, he used a wooden sword while she was barehanded. He won by a narrow margin after catching two solid kicks to the ribs.
"Who won there?" Vachette asked me.
I could tell she wasn't looking for the obvious answer.
"It's not much of a victory," I said. "She didn't even have a sword."
"She is of the third stone and far outstrips him as a fighter. It was the only way for things to be balanced between them unless he were to bring a companion to fight by his side," Vachette pointed out. "So I ask again, who won?"
"He won the bout," I said, "but he'll have some impressive bruises tomorrow. Also, his swing seemed somewhat reckless."
Vachette turned to look at me. "So who won?" I thought about it for a moment.
"Neither," I decided.
She nodded, formal approval. The gesture warmed me, as everyone facing us could see it. At long last, Cheyenne stepped into the circle. She had removed her lopsided yellow hat, and her graying hair swirled about in the wind. Seeing her among the other Adem, I realized how small she was. She carried herself with such confidence that I had come to think of her as taller, but she barely came up to the shoulder of some of the taller Adem. She carried a straight wooden sword with her. Nothing ornate, but it was carved to have the shape of a hilt and blade. Many of the other practice swords I had seen were barely more than smoothed sticks that gave the impression of being swords. Her white shirt and pants were tied tightly to her body with thin white cords. Alongside Cheyenne came a much younger woman. She was shorter than Cheyenne by an inch or so. Her frame was more delicate, too, her small face and shoulders making her look almost childlike. But the pronounced curve of her high breasts and round hips beneath her tight mercenary reds made it obvious she was no child. Her wooden sword was also carved. It was curved slightly, unlike most of the others I had seen. Her sandy hair was braided into a long, narrow plait that hung down to the small of her back. The two of them raised their swords and began to circle each other. The young woman was amazing. She struck so fast I could barely see the motion of her hand, let alone the blade of her sword. But Cheyenne brushed it away casually with drifting snow, taking half a step in retreat. Then, before Cheyenne could respond with an attack of her own, the young woman spun away, her long braid swinging.
"Who is she?" I asked.
"Penta," Vachette said admiringly. "She is a fury, is she not? Like one of our old ancestors." Penta closed with Cheyenne again, feinting and thrusting. She darted in, low to the ground, impossibly low. Her back leg thrust out for balance, not even touching the ground. Her sword arm licked out in front of her, her knee bent so deeply that her entire body was below the level of my head, even though I was sitting cross-legged on the ground. Penta unfurled all this sinuous motion as quickly as you can snap your fingers. The tip of her sword came in low under Cheyenne's guard and angled up toward her knee.
"What is that?"
I asked softly, not even expecting an answer.
"You never showed me that."
But it was just astonished noise. Never in 100 years could my body do that. But Cheyenne somehow avoided the attack, not leaping away with any sudden motion, not darting out of reach. She was quick, but that was not the heart of how she moved. Instead, she was deliberate and perfect. She was already halfway gone before Pentha's sword had begun to flick toward her leg. The tip of Pentha's sword must have come within an inch of her knee. but it was not a close thing. Cheyenne had only moved as much as was needed, no more. This time Cheyenne did manage to counterattack. Stepping forward with Sparrow strikes the hawk. Pentha rolled sideways, touched the grass briefly, then pushed herself up off the ground. No, she threw herself away from the ground, using only her left hand. Her body snapped like a steel spring, arcing away while her sword licked out twice, driving Cheyenne back. Pentha was full of passion and fury. Cheyenne was calm and steady. Pentha was a storm, Cheyenne a stone. Pentha was a tiger, and Cheyenne a bird. Pentha danced and wove madly. Cheyenne turned and took one single perfect step. Pentha slashed and spun and whirled and struck and struck and struck. And then they stopped. The tip of Pentha's wooden sword pressed to Cheyenne's white shirt. I gasped, though not loudly enough to draw any attention. Only then did I realize my heart was racing. My entire body was covered in sweat. Cheyenne lowered her sword, gesturing, irritation, admiration, and a mingling of other things I couldn't identify. She bared her teeth a little in a grimace and used her hand to chafe roughly at her ribs where Pentha had struck her. The same way you rub your shin when you bark it against a chair. Horrified, I turned to Vachette. "Will she be the new leader of the school?" I asked. Vachette looked at me, puzzled. I gestured to the open circle in front of us where the two women stood talking. "This Pentha, she's beaten Cheyenne." Vachette looked at me for a moment, uncomprehending, then burst out in a long, delighted laugh. "Cheyenne is old," she said. "She is a grandmother. You cannot expect her to always win against a limber young thing like Pentha, all full of fire and fresh wind." "Ah," I said. "I see." I thought Vachette was kind enough not to laugh at me again. "Cheyenne is not the head of the school because no one can beat her." What an odd notion. What chaos that would be, everything tipping this way and that, changing with the luck of one fight or another. She shook her head. "Cheyenne is the head because she is a marvelous teacher, and because her understanding of the Letani is deep. She is the head because she is wise in the ways of the world, and because she is clever at dealing with troublesome problems." She tapped me pointedly on the chest with two fingers. Then, Vachette made a conciliatory gesture. "She is also an excellent fighter, of course. We would not have a leader who could not fight. Cheyenne's Kaiten is without equal. But a leader is not a muscle. A leader is a mind." I looked up in time to see Cheyenne approaching. One of the cords holding her sleeve in place had come loose during the fight, and the cloth was fluttering in the wind like a luffing sail. She had donned her lopsided yellow cap again and gestured formal greeting to both of us. Then Cheyenne turned to me. "At the end," she asked, "why was I struck?" Curiosity. Frantically, I thought back to the final moments of the fight, looking them over in my mind's eye. I tried to gesture with the subtlety Vachette had been teaching me. Respectful uncertainty. "You misplaced your heel slightly," I said. "Your left heel." Cheyenne nodded. "Good." She gestured, pleased approval, widely enough so anyone who happened to be watching could see it. And of course, everyone was. Giddy with praise, but conscious of the fact I was being watched, I kept my face locked in the proper impassivity as Cheyenne walked away with Pentha in tow. I leaned my head close to Vachette's. "I like Cheyenne's little hat," I said. Vachette shook her head and sighed. "Come." She jostled my shoulder with her own and got to her feet. "We should leave before you spoil the good impression you have made today." That night at supper, I sat in my customary place at the corner of one table by the wall farthest from the food. Since no one was willing to sit within 10 feet of me, there was no sense my taking up space where people might actually want to sit. My good mood still buoyed me, so I was not surprised when I saw a flicker of red slide into the seat across from me. Karsa Red again. Once or twice a day, she made a point to come close enough to hiss a few words at me. She was overdue. But looking up, I was surprised. Vachette sat across from me. She nodded, her impassive face staring into my astonished one. Then I composed myself, nodded back, and we ate for a while in companionable silence. After we were finished eating, we passed some time pleasantly, speaking softly of small things. We left the dining hall together, and when we stepped into the evening air, I switched back into Aturin so I could properly articulate something I'd been thinking for several hours. "Vachette," I said, "it occurs to me it would be nice to fight someone whose ability is somewhat closer to my own." Vachette laughed, shaking her head. "That is like throwing two virgins into a bed. Enthusiasm, passion, and ignorance are not a good combination. Someone is likely to get hurt." "I hardly think it's fair to call my fighting virginal," I said. "I'm not near your level, but you yourself said my K-10 is remarkably good." "I said your K-10 was remarkably good considering the amount of time you have been studying," she corrected me, "which is less than 2 months, which is no time at all." "It's frustrating," I admitted. "If I strike a blow against you, it's because you let me. There's no substance to it. You've given it to me. I haven't earned it for myself." "Any strike or throw you make against me is earned," she said, "even if I offer it to you. But I understand. There is something to be said for honest competition." I started to say something else, but she put her hand over my mouth. "I've said I understand. Stop fighting after you have won." Hand still over my mouth, she tapped a finger thoughtfully. "Very well. Continue your progress and I will find you someone at your own level to fight." Chapter 116, Height. I was almost beginning to feel comfortable in Hert. My language was improving, and I felt less isolated now that I was able to exchange brief pleasantries with others. Vachette occasionally shared meals with me, helping me feel like slightly less of a pariah. We had done sword work this morning, which meant an easy start to the day. Vachette was still showing me how the sword was incorporated into the K-10, and the moments we fought were few and far between. After a few hours of this, we worked on my Ademic, then more sword work. After lunch, we moved on to hand fighting. I couldn't help but feel that here, at least, I was progressing well. After half an hour, not only was Vachette breathing harder, but she began to sweat a bit. I was still no sort of challenge to her, of course, but after days of humiliating nonchalance on her part, she was finally having to put forth a shred of effort to keep ahead of me. So we continued to fight, and I noticed that, how can I say this delicately? She smelled wonderful. Not like perfume or flowers or anything like that. She smelled like clean sweat and oiled metal and crushed grass from when I'd thrown her to the ground some time before. It was a good smell. I can't describe this delicately, I suppose. What I mean to say is that she smelled like sex. Not as if she'd been having it, as if she was made of it. When she came in close to grapple me, the smell of her combined with her body pressing against mine. For a second, it was like someone had thrown a switch in my head. All I could think of was kissing her mouth, biting the soft skin of her neck, tearing at her clothes and licking the sweat off her. I did none of these things, of course, but at the moment, I wanted nothing more. This is embarrassing to look back on, but I will not bother defending myself except to point out that I was in the full flower of my youth, fit and healthy, and she was quite an attractive woman, though 10 years my senior. Add to this the simple fact that I had gone from the loving arms of Falurian to the eager arms of Locine, and from thence to a long, barren stretch of training with Tempe as we traveled to Hert. That meant for 3 span I had been constantly exhausted, anxious, confused, and terrified by turns. Now, I was none of these things. Vachette was a good teacher and made sure I was well-rested and relaxed as possible. I was growing more confident in my abilities and more comfortable around her. Given all of this, it's no great surprise I had the reaction I did.
At the time, however, I was startled and embarrassed, as only a young man can be. I stepped away from Vachette, blushing and fumbling an apology. I tried to hide my obvious arousal, and in doing so only drew more attention to it. Vachette looked down at what my hands were trying vainly to conceal.
"Well, then, I suppose I will take that as a compliment and not a curious new avenue of attack."
If a person could die from shame, I would have.
"Would you like to take care of it yourself?" Vachette asked easily. "Or would you prefer a partner?"
"I beg your pardon?"
I said stupidly. "Come now." She gestured to my hands. "Even if you could keep your mind away from that, it would doubtless throw your balance off."
She gave a low, throaty chuckle.
"You'll need to tend to it before we continue your lessons. I can leave you to it, or we can find a soft spot and see who can pin the other best 2 of 3.
The casual tone of her voice convinced me I'd misunderstood her. Then she gave me a knowing smirk, and I realized I'd understood her perfectly well. "Where I come from, a teacher and a student would never..." I stumbled, trying to think of a polite way to defuse the situation. Vachette rolled her eyes at me, the exasperated expression looking odd on an Adam face.
"Do your teachers and students also never fight? Never talk? Never eat together?"
"But this," I said, "this..." She sighed.
"Quoth, you need to remember, you come from a barbarous place. Much of what you grew up thinking is quite wrong-headed and foolish, none of it as much as the strange customs you barbarians have built around your sex play."
"Vachette," I said, "I..." She cut me off with a sharp gesture. "Whatever you're about to say, I have doubtless heard before from my poet king. But there are only so many hours of light in the day. So I ask you this. Are you desirous of sex?" I gave a helpless shrug, knowing it would be pointless to deny it. "Would you like to have sex with me?" I could still smell her. At that moment, I wanted it more than anything.
"Yes."
"Are you free of disease?" she asked seriously. I nodded, too off balance to be startled by the frankness of the question. "Very well, then. If I remember correctly, there is a nice patch of moss out of the wind not too far from here." She began to walk up a nearby hill, her fingers working the buckle that fastened her sword's scabbard over her shoulder. "Come with me." Her memory did serve her well. Two trees arched their branches over a thick bed of soft moss that was snugged up against a small stony bluff, sheltered from the wind by some convenient bushes. It quickly became obvious that what Vachette had in mind was not an afternoon of twining idly in the shade. To say she was businesslike would be a great disservice to her, as Vachette's laughter always ran very close to the surface, but she was not flirtatious or coy. She stripped off her mercenary reds without the least fanfare or teasing, revealing a few scars and a body hard and lean and corded with muscle. Which isn't to say that she wasn't also round and soft as well. Then she teased me for staring as if I'd never seen a naked woman before, when the truth was, I'd simply never seen one standing full naked in the sunlight. When I didn't undress fast enough to suit her, Vachette laughed and mocked my bashfulness. Stepping close, she stripped me naked as a plucked chicken, then kissed me on the mouth, her warm skin pressing against the entire front of my body. "I've never kissed a woman my own height before," I mused when we stopped for a breath. "It's a different experience."
"See how I continue to be your teacher in all things," she said. "Your next lesson is this. All women are the same height lying down. The same cannot be said for your sort, of course. Too much depends on a man's mood and his natural gifts."
Vachette took my hand and brought us both to lie on the soft moss.
"There," she said, "as I suspected. Now you are taller than me. Does this set you at your ease?"
It did. I was prepared for things to be awkward after Vachette and I returned from the bushes, and was surprised to find they were nothing of the sort. She did not suddenly grow flirtatious,
which I wouldn't have known how to cope with. Neither did she feel obliged to treat me with any newfound tenderness. This became clear somewhere around the fifth time she managed to lure me off my guard, catch me with thunder upward, and throw me roughly to the ground. In all, she acted as if nothing odd at all had happened, which meant either nothing odd had happened, or something very odd had happened, and she was pointedly ignoring it, which meant that everything was lovely, or everything was going terribly wrong. Later, as I ate supper alone, I rolled what I knew of the A-Dem around in my head. No nudity taboo. They didn't consider physical contact particularly intimate. Vachette had been very casual both before, during, and after our encounter. I thought back to the naked couple I had stumbled onto several days ago. They had been startled, but not embarrassed. Sex was viewed differently here, obviously, but I didn't know any of the specific differences. That meant I didn't have the first idea of how to conduct myself properly. And that meant that what I was doing was dangerous as walking around blind. More like running blind, really. Normally, if I had a question about the A-Dem culture, I asked Vachette. She was my touchstone. But I could imagine too many ways for that conversation to go astray, and her goodwill was all that stood between me and the loss of my fingers. By the time I finished eating, I decided it would be best to simply follow Vachette's lead. She was my teacher, after all. Chapter 117, Barbarian Cunning. The days passed quickly, as days tend to do when there is much to fill them. Vachette continued to teach me, and I turned the whole of my attention toward being a clever and attentive student. Our amorous encounters continued, punctuating my training. I never initiated them directly, but Vachette could tell when I was unproductively distracted and was quick to pull me down into the bushes. "In order to clear your foolish barbarian head," as she said. Before and afterward, I still found these encounters troubling. During, however, I was far from anxious. Vachette seemed to enjoy herself as well. That said, she didn't seem the least interested in much of what I had learned from Felurian. She had no interest in playing Ivy, and while she did enjoy Thousand Hands, she had little patience for it, and it usually ended up being more like 75 hands. Generally speaking, as soon as we had caught our breath, Vachette was tying on her mercenary reds and reminding me that if I kept forgetting to turn my heel out, I would never be able to hit any harder than a boy of 6. Not all my time was spent training with Vachette. When she was busy, she set me to practice the K-10, consider the Lathani, or watch the other students spar. There were a few afternoons or evenings when Vachette simply sent me on my way. So I explored the surrounding town and discovered Haert was much larger than I'd originally assumed. The difference was that all its houses and shops weren't huddled together in a knot. They were scattered over several square miles of rocky hillside. I found the baths early on, by which I mean I was pointedly directed there by Vachette with instructions to wash off my barbarian stink. They were a marvel. A sprawling stone building built on top of what I guessed was either a natural hot spring or some marvelously engineered plumbing. There were large rooms full of water and small rooms full of steam. Rooms with deep pools for soaking and rooms with great brass tubs for scrubbing. There was even one room with a pool big enough for swimming. All through the building, the A-Dem mingled without any regard for age, gender, or state of undress. This didn't surprise me nearly as much as it would have a month ago, but it still took a great deal of getting used to. At first, I found it hard not to stare at the breasts of the naked women. Then, when some of that novelty faded, I found it hard not to stare at the scars that crossed the bodies of mercenaries. It was easy to tell who had taken the red even when their clothes were off. Rather than fight my urge to gawk, I found it easier to go early in the morning or late at night when the baths were largely empty. Coming and going at odd hours wasn't difficult, as there was no lock on the door. It was open at all hours for anyone to use. Soap and candles and towels were available for the taking. The baths, Vachette told me, were maintained by the school. I found the smithy by following the noise of ringing iron. The man working there was pleasantly talkative. He was glad to show me his tools and tell me the names for them in Ademic. Once I knew to look, I saw there were signs above the doors of the stores, pieces of wood carved or painted to show what was sold inside, bread, herbs, barrel staves. None of the signs had words, which was fortunate for me, as I had no idea how to read Ademic. I visited an apothecary where I was told I was not welcome, and a tailor where I was greeted warmly. I spent some of the 3 royals I'd stolen to buy 2 new sets of clothes, as those I had with me were showing their miles. I bought shirts and pants in muted colors after the local fashion, hoping they might help me fit in just a little better. I also spent many hours watching the sword tree. At first, I did this under Vachette's direction, but before long, I found myself drawn back when I had time of my own to spend. Its motions were hypnotic, comforting. At times, it seemed the branches wrote against the sky, spelling the name of the wind. True to her word, Vachette found me a sparring partner. "Her name is Celian," Vachette told me over breakfast. "Your first meeting will be at the sword tree at midday. You should take this morning to prepare yourself however you think is best." At last, a chance to prove myself, a chance to match wits with someone at my own level of skill, a real contest. I was at the sword tree early, of course, and when I first saw them approaching, I had a moment of confused panic when I thought the small figure at Vashat's side was Pentha, the woman who had beaten Shayan. Then I realized it couldn't be Pentha. The figure approaching with Vachette was short, but the wind revealed a straight, lean body with none of Pentha's curves. What's more, the figure wore a shirt of bright corn silk yellow, not mercenary red. I fought down a stab of disappointment, even though I knew it was foolish. Vachette had said she had found a fair fight for me. Obviously, it couldn't be someone who had already taken the red. They came closer still, and my excitement guttered and died. It was a little girl. Not even a young girl of 14 or so. It was a little girl, no more than 10 by my best guess. She was skinny as a twig, and so short her head barely made it up to my breastbone. Her gray eyes were huge in her tiny face. I was humiliated. The only thing that kept me from crying out in protest was the fact that I knew Vachette would find it unspeakably rude. "Celian, this is Quoth," Vachette said in Ademic. This young girl looked me up and down appraisingly, then took an unconscious half-step closer. A compliment. She considered me enough of a threat that she wanted to be close enough to strike at me if necessary. It was closer than an adult would have stood, because she was shorter. "Polite greeting," I gestured. Celian returned my gesture. It might have been my imagination, but it seemed the angle of her hands implied polite, non-subordinate greeting. If Vachette saw it, she made no comment. "It is my desire that the two of you fight." Celian looked me over again, her narrow face set in the typical Adem impassivity. The wind blew at her hair, and I could see a half-healed cut running from above her eyebrow up into her hairline.
"Why?"
the girl asked calmly. She didn't seem afraid. It sounded more as if she couldn't think of the least reason she would want to fight me. "Because there are things you can learn from each other," Vachette said, "and because I say you will." Vachette gestured to me. "Attend. Celian's Kaithen is quite exceptional. She has years of experience and is easily the match of any 2 girls her size." Vachette tapped Celian on the shoulder twice. "Caution. Quoth, on the other hand, is new to the Kaithen and has much to learn. But he is stronger than you and taller with a better reach. He also possesses a barbarian's cunning." I looked at Vachette, unsure if she were poking fun at me or not. "Also," Vachette continued to Celian, "you will very likely have your mother's height when you are grown, so you should practice fighting those larger than yourself. Attend. Lastly, he is new to our language, and for this you will not mock him." The girl nodded. I noticed Vachette hadn't specified I couldn't be mocked for other reasons. Vachette straightened and spoke formally. "Nothing with the intention to injure.
She held up fingers, marking the rules she had taught me when we started hand-fighting. You may strike hard, but not viciously. Be careful of the head and neck, and nothing at all toward the eyes. You are each responsible for the other's safety. If one of you gains a solid submission against the other, do not attempt to break it. Signal fairly, and count at the end of the bout.
I know this, Celian said, irritation.
It bears repeating, Vachette said, stern rebuke. Losing a fight is forgivable. Losing your temper is not. This is why I have brought you here instead of some little boy. Did I choose wrongly?
Celian looked down, apologetic regret, embarrassed acceptance.
Vachette addressed us both. Injuring another through carelessness is not of the Lathani. I couldn't see how my beating up a 10-year-old girl was of the Lathani either, but I knew better than to say so. And with that, Vachette left us alone, walking to a stone bench some 40 feet away where another woman in mercenary reds was sitting. Celian made a complicated gesture I didn't recognize toward Vachette's back. Then, the young girl turned to face me, looking me up and down.
You are the first barbarian I have fought, she said after a long moment. Are you all red?
She lifted her hand to her own hair to clarify her meaning. I shook my head. Not many of us. She hesitated, then reached out her hand.
Can I touch it?
I almost smiled at this, but caught myself. I ducked my head a bit and bent down so she could reach. Celian ran her hand through my hair, then rubbed some between her thumb and forefinger.
It's soft.
She gave a little laugh.
But it looks like metal.
She let go of my hair and stepped back to a formal distance again. She gestured polite thanks, then brought up her hands.
Are you ready?
I nodded uncertainly, bringing up my own hands. I wasn't ready. Celian darted forward, catching me flat-footed. Her arm drove out in a punch straight toward my groin. Raw instinct made me crouch so it struck my stomach instead. Luckily, by this point, I knew how to take a punch, and a month of hard training had made my stomach a sheet of muscle. Still, it felt like someone had thrown a rock at me, and I knew I'd have a bruise by dinner. I got my feet under me and flicked an exploratory kick at her. I wanted to see how skittish she was, and hoped to make her back away so I could get my balance settled and make better use of my longer reach. It turned out Celian wasn't skittish at all. She didn't back away. Instead, she slipped alongside my leg and struck me squarely in the thick knot of muscle directly above the knee. Because of this, I couldn't help but stagger when my foot came back down, leaving me off balance with Celian close enough to climb me if she wanted. She set her hands together, braced her feet, and struck me with threshing wheat. The force of it knocked me over backward. Given the thick grass, it wasn't a hard landing. I rolled to get some distance and came back to my feet. Celian chased me and made thrown lightning. She was fast, but I had longer legs and managed to back away or block everything she threw. She faked a kick, and I fell for it, giving her the opportunity to hit me right above the knee in the same place as before. It hurt, but I didn't stagger this time, instead stepping sideways and away. Still, she followed me, relentless and overeager. And in her haste, she left an opening. But despite the bruises and the fall she'd already given me, I couldn't bring myself to throw a punch at such a tiny girl. I knew how solidly I could hit Tempe or Vachette. But Celian was such a tiny twig of a thing. I worried I would hurt her. Hadn't Vachette said we were responsible for each other's safety? So instead, I grabbed her with climbing iron. My left hand missed, but the long, strong fingers of my right hand wrapped all the way around her slender wrist. I didn't have her in the proper submission, but now it was a game of strength, and I couldn't help but win. I already had her wrist. All that remained was to grip her shoulder, and I'd have her in Sleeping Bear before... Celian made Break Lion, but it wasn't the version I had learned. Hers used both hands, striking and twisting so quickly that my hand was stinging and empty before I could think. Then she grabbed my wrist and pulled, lashing out to kick my leg in a fluid motion. I leaned, buckled, and she stretched me out flat above the ground. This landing wasn't soft, more a jarring flop onto the grass. It didn't completely stun me, but that didn't matter because Celian simply reached out and tapped my head twice, signaling that if she'd wanted to, she could easily have knocked me unconscious. I rolled into a sitting position, aching in several places and with a sprained pride. It wasn't badly sprained, though. My time with Tempe and Vashat had taught me to appreciate skill, and Celian's Catan truly was excellent. "I've never seen that version of Break Lion before," I said. Celian grinned. It was only a small grin, but it still showed a glimpse of her white teeth. In the world of Adam impassivity, it was like the sun coming from behind a cloud.
"That is mine," she said, extreme pride. "I made it. I am not strong enough to use regular Break Lion against my mother or anyone your size."
"Would you show it to me?" I asked. Celian hesitated, then nodded and stepped forward, holding out her hand.
"Grab my wrist."
I took hold of it, gripping firmly, but not fiercely. She did it again, like a magic trick. Both of her hands moved in a flurry of motion, and I was left with a stinging, empty hand. I reached out again, amusement. "I have slow barbarian eyes. Could you make it again so I can learn it?" Celian stepped back, shrugging. Indifference.
"Am I your teacher? Should I give something of mine to a barbarian who cannot even strike me in the fight?"
She lifted her chin and looked off toward the spinning sword tree, but her eyes darted back to me playfully. I chuckled and came to my feet, bringing up my hands again. She laughed and turned to face me.
"Go!"
This time, I was ready, and I knew what Celian was capable of. She was no sort of delicate flower. She was quick and fearless and aggressive. So I went on the offensive, taking advantage of my long arms and legs. I struck out with Dancing Maiden, but she skipped away. No, it would be better to say she slid away from me, never compromising her balance in the least, her feet weaving smoothly through the long grass. Then she changed direction suddenly, catching me between steps and slightly off my stride. She feigned a punch at my groin, then pushed me slightly off balance with turning millstone. I staggered, but managed to keep my feet beneath me. I tried to regain my balance, but she brushed me again with turning millstone, then again, and again. Each time only shoving me a few inches, but it kept me in a helpless stumbling retreat until she managed to plant her foot behind mine, tripping me and sending me flat onto my back. Before I'd finished striking the ground, she already had hold of my wrist, and soon had my arm tangled firmly in ivy on the oak. This pressed my face into the grass while putting uncomfortable pressure against my wrist and shoulder. For a second, I considered trying to struggle free, but only for a second. I was stronger than she was, but the whole point of positions like ivy on the oak and sleeping bear is to put pressure on the fragile parts of the body. You did not need a great deal of strength to attack the branch.
"I submit," I said.
This is easier to say in Ademic. "Veh," an easy noise to make when you are winded, tired, or in pain. I'd become rather used to saying it lately. Celian let go of me and stepped away, watching as I sat up.
"You really aren't very good," she said with brutal honesty.
"I'm not used to striking young girls," I said.
"How could you become used to it?" she laughed. "To grow used to a thing, you must do it over and again. I expect you have never struck a woman even once."
Celian extended a hand. I took it in what I hoped was a gracious manner, and she helped pull me to my feet. "I mean, where I come from, it is not right to fight with women."
"I do not understand," she said. "Do they not let the men fight in the same place as the women?"
"I mean, for the most part, our women do not fight," I explained. Celian rolled her wrist over, opening and closing her hand as if there were some dirt on the palm and she was absent-mindedly trying to rub it off. It was the hand-talk equivalent of puzzlement, a confused frown of sorts.
"How do they improve their K-10 if they do not practice?" she asked.
"Where I come from, the women have no K-10 at all." Her eyes narrowed, then brightened.
"You mean to say they have a secret K-10,
she said, using the Aeturan word for secret. Though her face was composed, her body vibrated with excitement.
"A K-10 only they know, that the men are not allowed to see.
Celian pointed over to the bench where our teachers sat ignoring us.
Vachette has such a thing. I have asked her to show it to me many times, but she will not.
Vachette knows another Catan? I asked.
Celian nodded. She was schooled in the path of joy before she came to us.
She looked over at her, her face serious, as if she would pull the secret out of the other woman by sheer force of will.
Someday, I will go there and learn it. I will go everywhere, and I will learn all the Catans there are. I will learn the hidden ways of the ribbon and the chain and of the moving pool. I will learn the paths of joy and passion and restraint. I will have all of them.
When she spoke, Celian didn't say this in a tone of childish fancy, as if she were daydreaming of eating an entire cake. Neither was she boastful, as if she were describing a plan she had put together on her own and thought very clever. Celian said it with a quiet intensity. It was almost as if she were simply explaining who she was. Not to me. She was telling herself. She turned back to look at me.
I will go to your land too, she said, absolute. And I will learn the barbarian Catan your women keep secret from you.
You will be disappointed, I said. I did not misspeak. I know the word for secret. What I meant to say is that where I come from, many women do not fight. Celian rolled her wrist again in puzzlement, and I knew I had to be more clear. Where I come from, most women spend their whole lives without holding a sword. Most grow up not knowing how to strike another with a fist or the blade of their hand. They know nothing of any sort of Catan. They do not fight at all. I stressed the last two words with strong negation. That finally seemed to get the point across to her. I had half expected her to look horrified, but instead, she simply stood there blankly, hands motionless, as if at a loss for what to think. It was as if I'd just explained to her that the women where I came from didn't have any heads.
They do not fight? She asked dubiously. Not with the men, or with each other, or with anyone at all?
I nodded. There was a long, long pause. Her brow furrowed, and I could actually see her struggling to come to grips with this idea. Confusion. Dismay.
Then what do they do? She said at last.
I thought of the women I knew. Mola, Fella, Davy. Many things, I said, having to improvise around the words I didn't know. They make pictures out of stones. They buy and sell money. They write in books. Celian seemed to relax as I recited this list, as if relieved to hear these foreign women, empty of any Catan, weren't strewn around the countryside like boneless corpses. They heal the sick and mend wounds. They play... I almost said play music and sing songs, but caught myself in time. They play games and plant wheat and make bread. Celian thought for a long moment.
I would rather do those things and fight as well, she said decisively.
Some women do, but for many it is considered not of the Lathani. I used the phrase of the Lathani because I could not think of how to say proper behavior in Ademic. Celian gestured sharp disdain and reproach. I was amazed how much more it stung coming from this young girl in her bright yellow shirt than it ever had from Tempi or Vachette.
The Lathani is the same everywhere, she said firmly. It is not like the wind changing from place to place.
The Lathani is like water, I responded without thinking. It is itself unchanging, but it shapes itself to fit all places. It is both the river and the rain. She glared at me. It was not a furious glare, but coming from one of the Adem, it had the same effect.
Who are you to say the Lathani is like one thing and not another?
Who are you to do the same? Celian looked at me for a moment, the hint of a serious line between her pale eyebrows. Then she laughed brightly and brought up her hands.
I am Celian, she proclaimed. My mother is of the third stone. I am Adem born, and I am the one who would throw you to the ground. She was as good as her word.
Chapter 118. Purpose. Vachette and I fought, moving back and forth across the foothills of Ademre. After all this time, I barely noticed the wind anymore. It was as much a part of the landscape as the uneven ground beneath my feet. Some days it was gentle, and did little more than make patterns in the grass or flick my hair into my eyes. Other days it was strong enough to make the loose fabric of my clothes crack and snap against my skin. It could come at you from unexpected directions without a moment's warning, pushing you as firmly as a hand between your shoulder blades. "Why do we spend so much time on my hand fighting?" I asked Vachette as I made picking clover. "Because your hand fighting is sloppy," Vachette said, blocking me with fan water. "Because you embarrass me every time we fight, and because 3 times of 4 you lose to a child half your size." "But my sword fighting is even worse," I said as I circled, looking for an opening. "It is worse," she acknowledged. "That is why I do not let you fight anyone but me. You are too wild. You could hurt someone." I smiled. "I thought that was the point of this." Vachette frowned, then reached out casually to grip my wrist and shoulder, twisting me into Sleeping Bear. Her right hand held my wrist over my head, stretching my arm at an awkward angle, while her left pressed firmly against my shoulder. Helpless, I was forced to bend at the waist, staring at the ground. "There," I said in submission. But Vachette didn't release me. She twisted, and the pressure against my shoulder increased. The small bones of my wrist began to ache. "There," I said a little louder, thinking she hadn't heard me. But still, she held me, twisting a little harder at my wrist. "Vachette!" I tried to turn my head to look at her, but from this angle, all I could see was her leg. "If the point of this is to hurt someone," she said, "why should I let you go?"
"That's not what I meant!"
Vachette pushed down harder, and I stopped talking.
"What is the purpose of Sleeping Bear?" she asked calmly.
"To incapacitate your opponent," I said.
"Very well."
Vachette began to bear down with the slow, relentless force of a glacier. Dull pain began to build in my shoulder as well as my wrist.
"Soon your arm will be twisted from the cup of your shoulder. Your tendons will stretch and pull free of the bone. Your muscles will tear and your arm will hang like a wet rag at your side. Then will Sleeping Bear have served its purpose?"
I struggled a bit out of pure animal instinct, but it only turned the burning pain into something sharper, and I stopped. Over the course of my training, I had been put into inescapable positions before. Every time I had been helpless, but this time was the first time I had truly felt that way.
"The purpose of Sleeping Bear is control," Vachette said calmly. "Right now, you are mine to do with as I wish. I can move you, or break you, or let you free."
"I would prefer free," I said,
trying to sound more hopeful than desperate. There was a pause. Then she asked calmly,
"What is the purpose of Sleeping Bear?"
"Control!"
I felt her hands release me, and I stood, slowly rolling my shoulder to ease the ache. Vachette stood there, frowning at me.
"The point of all of this is control. First, you must have control of yourself. Then you can gain control of your surroundings. Then you gain control of whoever stands against you. This is the Letani."
After the better part of a month in Hert, I could not help but feel that things were going well. Vachette acknowledged that my language was improving, congratulating me by saying I sounded like a child rather than just an imbecile. I continued to meet with Celian in the grassy field next to the sword tree. I looked forward to these encounters, despite the fact that she thrashed me with cheerful ruthlessness every time we fought. It took 3 days before I finally managed to beat her. That's an interesting verse to add to the long story of my life, isn't it? "Come listen all, and I will tell a tale of brave and daring deeds, of wonders cloth the bloodless rot, and of the time he bravely fought, a twiggling girl no more than 10, and listen how it came to pass, the mighty blow he bravely dealt, that knocked her sprawling to the grass, and of the glow of joy he felt.
Awful as it might sound, I was proud, and justifiably so. Celian herself congratulated me when it happened, seeming more than a little surprised that I had managed it. There, in the long shadow of the sword tree, she showed me her two-handed variant of breaking lion as a reward, flattering me with the familiarity of an impish grin. That same day we finished our prescribed number of bouts early. I went to sit on a nearby lump of stone that had been smoothed into a comfortable seat. I nursed my dozen small hurts from the fight and prepared to watch the sword tree until Vachette returned to fetch me. Celian, however, was not the sort to sit and wait. She skipped over to the sword tree, standing only a few feet from where the longest branches bobbed and danced in the wind, sending the round, razor-sharp leaves turning in wild circles. Then she lowered her shoulders and darted under the canopy in among the thousand madly spinning leaves. I was too startled to cry out, but I did come halfway to my feet before I heard her laughing. I watched as she darted and jigged and spun, her tiny body dodging out of the way of the wind-tossed leaves as if she were playing tag. She made it halfway to the trunk and stopped. She ducked her head, reached out, and swatted away a leaf that otherwise would have cut her. No, she didn't just lash out. She used drifting snow. Then I watched her move even closer to the trunk, weaving back and forth and protecting herself. First, she used maiden combs her hair, then danced backwards. Then she skipped to one side, the katan abandoned. She crouched and sprinted through a gap in the leaves and made her way to the trunk of the tree, slapping it with one hand. And she was back among the leaves. She made pressing cider, ducked and spun and ran until she was clear of the canopy. She didn't shout out in triumph as a Commonwealth child might have, but she jumped into the air, hands raised in victory. Then, still laughing, she did a cartwheel. Breathless, I watched Celian play her game again and again, moving in and out of the tree's dancing leaves. She didn't always make it to the trunk. Twice, she scampered back out of the reach of the leaves without making it, and it was obvious, even from where I sat, that she was angry. Once, she slipped and was forced to crawl out under the reach of the leaves. But she made it to the trunk and back 4 times, each time celebrating her escape with upraised hands, laughter, and a single perfect cartwheel. She only stopped when Vachette returned. I watched from a distance as Vachette stormed over and gave the girl a stern telling off. I couldn't hear what was said, but their body language spoke volumes. Celian looked down and shuffled her feet. Vachette shook a finger and cuffed the young girl on the side of her head. It was the same scolding any child receives. Stay out of the neighbor's garden. Don't tease the Benton sheep. Don't play tag among the thousand spinning knives of your people's sacred tree. Chapter 119. Hands. Once Vachette judged my language only moderately embarrassing, she arranged for me to talk with an odd handful of people scattered around Hert. There was a garrulous old man who spun silk thread while chattering endlessly, telling strange, pointless, half-delirious stories. There was a story of a boy who put shoes on his head to keep a cat from being killed. Another where a family swore to eat a mountain stone by stone. I could never make any sense of them, but I listened politely and drank the sweet beer he offered me. I met with twin sisters who made candles and showed me the steps of strange dances. I spent an afternoon with a woodcutter who spoke for hours of nothing but splitting wood. At first, I thought these were important members of the community. I thought Vachette might be parading me in front of them in order to show how civilized I had become. It wasn't until I spent the morning with Two Fingers that I realized she sent me to each of these people with the hope I would learn something. Two Fingers was not his real name. I'd merely come to think of him as that. He was a cook at the school, and I saw him at every meal. His left hand was whole, but his right was viciously crippled, with only his thumb and forefinger remaining. Vachette sent me to him in the morning, and together we prepared lunch and talked. His name was Naden. He told me he had spent 10 years among the barbarians.
What's more, he had brought more than 230 silver talents back into the school before he was injured and could no longer fight. He mentioned the last several times, and I could tell that it was a particular point of pride with him. The bells rang, and folk filtered into the dining hall. Naden ladled up the stew we'd made, hot and thick with chunks of beef and carrot,